This is Kathy coming to you with the Decatur Herald and Review, and I'll be reading mostly the Monday paper. We may pick up a few articles from Sunday. Headline today, the lines drawn in pharma clash, disputed memo, expanded drug discounts to cost millions. A proposal that would expand access to a federal program that discounts the price of prescription drugs could end up costing Illinois employers an additional $89 million a year, including more than $12 million a year for the state of Illinois itself. That's according to a memo dated May 12th from the Department of Central Management Services, the state agency that administers the state employee health plan, to Representative Travis Weaver, Republican of Edwards, who requested the information following a meeting of the Legislative Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, or COGFA. Capital News Illinois obtained a copy of the memo through a third party, but groups representing healthcare organizations quickly disputed its findings. The proposal contained in a Senate amendment to House Bill 2371 is intended to give federally qualified health centers, Ryan White AIDS clinics, safety net hospitals, and other healthcare providers that serve large volumes of Medicaid patients greater access to what is known as the 340B drug pricing program. What is that? That's a federal program established in 1992 that requires drug manufacturers to provide drugs to those facilities at substantially discounted prices. Those facilities then mark the price back up when they dispose or prescribe the drugs to their patients. That spread between their acquisition cost and the price they charge becomes an indirect revenue stream that helps feed their bottom line. The bill pending in the General Assembly, which awaits a final vote in the House, would prohibit drug companies from restricting the ability of those hospitals and clinics to acquire those discounted drugs through contract pharmacies. That's something many clinics and safety net hospitals say they've experienced in recent years, limiting their ability to acquire drugs at the discounted prices. The bill would also prohibit drug manufacturers from requiring a 340B qualified hospital and clinics to report ingredient cost or pricing data, to report how they manage inventory of 340B drugs, or to submit any data or information not required by state or federal law as a condition of participating in the 340B program. The bill has generated enormous lobbying campaigns on both sides of the issue, shedding light on the complexities of how prescription drugs are priced in the United States and how a seemingly small change in one area can have far-reaching unintended consequences. During an April 14th COGFA hearing, Sean Greminger, president and CEO of the National Alliance of Healthcare Purchaser Coalitions, explained how the 340B program has grown beyond what anyone expected when it was created. It was a program designed to be so small they didn't bother giving it a name, he said. Literally, it's called 340B because it just sits at Section 340B of the Public Health Service Act. It was a program to be designed to be so small they didn't bother giving it a name. Literally, it's called 340B because that's where it sits. Sean Greminger, president and CEO of the National Alliance of Healthcare Purchaser Coalitions. Over the years, he said, as Medicaid programs expanded, so too did the number of hospitals that were able to qualify for the 340B drug program. And as those hospitals became eligible, Greminger said, all of the affiliated clinics and medical practices became eligible too. Today, Greminger said, the 340B program is the second largest drug purchasing program in the country, behind Medicare Part D and growing by an average of 15% to 20% each year. In Minnesota, he said, one hospital operated by the University of Minnesota earns more money through the 340B program than all of the state's rural hospitals, community health centers, and Ryan White AIDS clinics combined. But groups representing the healthcare organizations who would benefit from House Bill 2371 questioned the memo and called attention to the expensive lobbying campaign aimed at killing it. The memo released this week by CMS simply regurgitated Big Pharma's testimony from the April 14th COGFA hearing. Illinois Health and Hospital Association President and CEO A.J. Wilhelmy said in a statement, the footnotes in the memo clearly indicate that the research referenced in the memo was funded by Big Pharma. So, unsurprisingly, Big Pharma is trying to misrepresent the government's position on the legislation. Groups including the Illinois Council of Health System Pharmacists and the Illinois Pharmacists Association say that Illinois legislation preserves the original intent of the 340B program rather than expands it. The problem for many health insurance plans like Illinois State Employees Group Insurance Program, or SIGIP, is that when their members go to a 340B qualifying hospital or clinic, those plans pay the full marked up price for any drugs their members receive. But the plans no longer receive any manufacturer's rebate for the drugs they purchase, thus raising the net cost of prescription drugs for patients enrolled in those plans. Effectively, our rebates are crowded out by the 340B rebate, Grimminger said. The 340B program was created by Congress to help low-income and uninsured patients access medicines, but it's difficult for Illinois to confirm that its patients are benefiting as intended or to understand the impact on taxpayers and employers, Will May of the pharmaceutical trade organization PhRMA said in a statement. Following that meeting, Weaver requested additional information from CMS, including an estimate of the fiscal impact passage of House Bill 2371 would have on the state employee health plan. Independent analysis estimates that the current 340B program costs Illinois employers approximately $224 million annually, with the proposed legislation expected to increase those costs by an additional $89 million, CMS said in the memo. For SIGIP specifically, lost rebates are estimated at $31 million annually, with an additional projected impact of $12.4 million under the proposed legislation. The memo cites an analysis published in 2024 by the Health Industry Research and Technology Forum, IQVIA. The healthcare groups, however, say the study was funded by the National Pharmaceutical Council and thus provides untrustworthy data. The focus of this conversation should remain on the Illinois patients and providers who depend on the 340B program, not on the financial interests of the pharmaceutical industry, Ali Idowu, president and CEO of Illinois Primary Healthcare Association, said in a statement. As debate over House Bill 2371 continues, lawmakers will be asked to weigh the estimated cost to employers, including the state of Illinois itself, with the cost currently being borne by community health clinics and other providers who were originally intended to benefit from the program. Cyrus Winnett, executive director of the Illinois Primary Healthcare Association, a group that represents federally qualified health centers, said during an interview in March that under current law, drug manufacturers have been able to restrict the number of pharmacies or suppliers where clinics can acquire 340B discounted drugs, thus limiting their ability to reap the financial benefit. What pharmaceutical manufacturers began doing was limiting the distribution of these drugs to a single location, he said. And when I say a single location, I don't mean Walgreens chain or CVS or a local independent. I mean one physical location, which for our organizations and their patients have wide service areas. That's extremely limiting. The proposed legislation originated in the Senate as an amendment to a bill that had previously passed the House. That amendment passed the Senate on May 29, 2025 by a vote of 55-0. It then went back to the House for a vote to concur in the Senate amendment, but so far the House has not taken further action. Senator Dave Kohler, Democrat of Peoria, who sponsored the amendment last year, said during the April 14th COGFA hearing that the current system of pricing and delivering drugs in the healthcare marketplace is imperfect, but that lawmakers can only work with the tools they have. Is this the best way to cover rural hospitals or FQHCs? No, it's not, he said. But you know what? Congress gives us the tools that we have to use. And when we have rural hospitals in our area or FQHCs or poor people that are now being kicked off Medicaid, we have to respond to our constituents. This report was from the Capital News Illinois, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news service that distributes state government coverage to hundreds of state news outlets. It is funded primarily by the Illinois Press Foundation and the Robert R. McCormick Foundation. In this article, why are so many lawmakers retiring? Those leaving cite lack of order and low productivity, by Valerie Yerk and Savannah Bierman on the CQ Roll Call. As more lawmakers than usual leave Congress, it begs the question, is this a one-off spike or a larger sign of things to come? Retirement announcements are a feature of any election year, but this goes beyond normal turnover, experts say. Bitterly partisan redistricting pushes around the country have created a state of constant uncertainty that only adds to the political polarization and low legislative productivity that's plagued Capitol Hill. To date, 36 House Republicans and 20 Democrats have said they won't return to the chamber next year, either because they're running for another office or are giving up public service altogether. representing the largest number of retirements since the 1992 cycle, according to Brookings. That count doesn't include members who died, resigned, or lost their primary. In the Senate, 11 senators are leaving the chamber, including 7 Republicans and 4 Democrats. The cohort represents a range of fresh-faced and seasoned lawmakers, but a few points stick out. Most of them are Republican, and of the House Republicans, over 85% hail from safe red districts, according to roll call analysis. Similarly, in the Senate, where experts see the GOP as having a stronger chance of keeping the majority come November, only a couple of Republicans in purple competitive states are leaving, while the rest are considered to be ruby red. In other words, the data suggests that members are leaving for reasons other than regular midterm pressure, said Casey Burgett, Legislative Affairs Program Director and Associate Professor at George Washington University. The number of folks who are leaving voluntarily, particularly in safe seats, may not be facing a credible primary challenger. This is a signal they want to do something else. They're not being satisfied by the job of being a member of Congress, he said. The reasons for all of that can be many and varied, but it's some combination of the partisanship and the unlikelihood of getting anything done legislatively. Burgett said the biggest complaint he hears is that lawmakers can't get anything done anymore, even if they have an idea that's supported by leadership in the majority party. We've seen some members in their press releases or in interviews since their announcements literally outright say they can do more good on the outsides of the chamber than they can on the inside, Burgett said. That's an alarm bell. Representative Mark Amodi, representative of Nevada, is retiring after 15 years in the House. Things that might have been easy, like partisan things, you'd think, oh, well, we're in the majority, we'll be fine. But it's like, no, in some ways you've got to work just as hard or harder than before, he said. Representative Ren Zinke, Republican of Vermont, of Montana, who's leaving after serving more than 3 terms plus a stint in the first Trump administration's cabinet, said he's been frustrated with the lack of a traditional committee-centered approach to legislating. There's some frustration about lack of rules, lack of regular order, and there's a loss of muscle memory on what regular order even is, he said. For some who've already departed, the mass exodus isn't much of a surprise. Former Representative Debbie Marcarse Castle Powell, Democrat of Florida, who now leads George Washington University's political management graduate program, said there was a lot of energy when she was elected and the Democrats won the majority. I think a lot of those members are seeing the stronghold of the 2 opposing parties. The control of leadership from their parties makes it very difficult for the members to work for their constituents, she said. Former Representative Dan Kildee, Democrat of Michigan, added, Congress isn't quite the place it was when I first came to know it. Now there's a whole set of members that quantify their success based on, you know, the number of clicks, he said. Burgett said a good portion of lawmakers who aren't returning next Congress are workhorse types who seem to be disillusioned with increasingly political polarization and low legislative productivity. In turn, the current conditions tend to starve the workhorse and incentivize the show horse or members who seem to vie for the spotlight, he said. And also on the front page, UAE, which is the Middle East, reports drone strike. Trump again threatens Iran. And there is a picture here. It says a presenter from Iran State TV fires a gun at a UAE flag in a studio Friday in Tehran, Iran. Dubai. A drone strike caused a fire at a nuclear power plant in the United Arab Emirates, officials in Abu Dhabi said Sunday. At a time when progress appears to have stalled in efforts to end the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran and restart shipping in the Gulf. Emirati officials said they were investigating the source of the strike and that the UAE had the full right to respond to such terrorist attacks. The UAE previously accused Iran of attacking its energy targets in what it has called an escalation of the conflict in the region. Also on Sunday, President Donald Trump threatened consequences for Iran if its leaders do not act quickly. For Iran, the clock is ticking and they better get moving fast or there won't be anything left of them. Time is of the essence, he wrote in a Truth Social post. The drone hit an electrical generator outside the inner perimeter of the Barakah nuclear power plant, the Abu Dhabi media office said. Radiological safety levels were unaffected and there were no injuries, it said. The International Atomic Energy Agency said the emergency diesel generators were providing power to the plant's Unit 3 and called for maximum military restraint near any nuclear power plant, adding that it was following the situation closely. The UAE Defense Ministry said two other drones were successfully dealt with and that the drones were launched from the western border. It did not elaborate. During the war that began February 28th with the U.S. and Israeli strikes against Iran, Iran has repeatedly targeted the UAE and other Gulf states that host U.S. military bases, hitting sites that include civilian and energy infrastructure. Iran stepped up such attacks on the UAE earlier this month after Trump announced a naval mission to try to open the Strait of Hormuz, which he suspended after 48 hours. More than 5 weeks after a tenuous ceasefire in the conflict took effect, U.S. and Iranian demands remain far apart, despite diplomatic efforts to end the war and reopen the strait, the world's most important shipping route for oil and gas. Washington called for Tehran to dismantle its nuclear program and lift its hold on the strait. Iran has demanded compensation for war damage, an end to the U.S. blockade of Iranian ports, and a halt to fighting on all fronts, including in Lebanon, where Israel is battling Iran-backed Hezbollah. Trump, who held talks with Chinese President Xi Jinping last week without securing an indication from China that it would help resolve the conflict, threatened to resume attacks if Iran does not agree to a deal. A senior spokesperson for the Iranian Armed Forces, Abu Fazl Shikarchi, said Sunday that if Trump's threats were carried out, the U.S. would face new aggressive and surprise scenarios and sink into a self-made quagmire. Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Ismail Bakai said the U.S. and Israel tried to shift the blame for destabilizing energy markets following their unprovoked military aggression against Iran. The disruption to shipping through the Strait of Hormuz has caused the biggest oil supply crisis in history, pushing up prices. The U.S. has imposed its own blockade of Iranian ports and said that as of Sunday, it had redirected 81 commercial vessels and disabled 4 vessels to ensure compliance. Ibrahim Azizi, who heads the Iranian parliament's National Security Committee, said Saturday that Tehran prepared a mechanism to manage traffic through the strait along a designated route that would be unveiled soon. Thousands of Iranians were killed in the U.S. and Israeli airstrikes. Thousands more have been killed in Lebanon in fighting between Israel and the Iran-backed group Hezbollah. Israel and Lebanon agreed Friday to a 45-day extension of a ceasefire there, though the truce has failed to end clashes. And now on to page A3. Gunfire erupts on Dennis Avenue by Tony Reed. Mystery surrounds a sudden burst of gunfire late Saturday night outside a Decatur home. Patrol officers responding to reports of shots fired at 11:45 p.m. in the area of North Dennis and West Harrison Avenues found 27 spent bullet casings in the front yard of a house in the 2100 block of North Dennis Avenue. There were 4 different calibers of shell casing, all handgun calibers, said Sergeant Philip Ganley with the Decatur Police Department. Officers talked to the male resident of the house where they located the shell casings, and he said he'd heard the gunshots but didn't know anything about it. Actually, the resident said he didn't even know there were gunshots. He just heard loud noises. Ganley said officers could see no signs of property damage from the gunfire, and there were no reports of injuries. This headline, Big House Ballgame Celebrates Route 66 by Julia Levy from Joliet. At the old Joliet prison, made famous by the Blues Brothers film, the Joliet Slammers baseball team staff were generously handing out tickets to a ballgame recently, helping kick off the statewide celebration of the Route 66 centennial. But at this so-called Big House ballgame, you might have needed a get-out-of-jail-free card to leave. That's because the Joliet Slammers baseball team historic exhibition used the prison yard to launch the months-long festivities marking the Mother Road's 100th birthday near the old path of U.S. Route 66. The high walls, barbed wire, and guard towers served as a jailhouse ballgame reminder. Guests entered where Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi filmed the beginning of the movie The Blues Brothers. Iconic actor Bill Murray, who is part of the ownership team, was also present at the Frontier League exhibition games on April 30th, which brought baseball back to the prison for the first time since it closed in 2002. Once inside the prison walls, Quinn Adamowski, Joliet Area Historical Museum Board President and lifelong Joliet resident, welcomed the crowd. For decades, residents and visitors alike wondered about this site and wondered about inside the walls. For these decades, the site defined Joliet in many ways, Adamowski said. The museum partnered with Robert Navarro, president and CEO of Heritage Quarter Destinations, and submitted the grant to put the event through the Illinois Office of Tourism, aiming to bring Illinoisans together to celebrate. Not only did Illinois show up for the game, so did Hollywood. Many spectators were adorned in pop culture costumes and references from the realms of Illinois baseball and incarceration, including the Black Sox from the Field of Dreams and the Ghostbusters and the Stars from Prison Break. And, of course, the Blues Brothers. This game fits into a larger piece of Illinois history. Katie Sheehan, the Deputy Director of the Illinois Office of Tourism, announced the beginning of the Route 66 events at the game. "You know, Route 66 is all about memorable stops," Sheehan said. "And I've got to say that a ball game at a prison shoots right to the top of the list of memorable stops. So it's great to be incarcerated with everyone here today." The game was only the beginning of many festive Route 66 Illinois events that will be taking place this year, sponsored and organized by the Illinois Route 66 Centennial Commission. Joliet is one of nearly 100 communities along the 300-mile Illinois stretch of the Mother Road from Chicago to Pontiac, Bloomington, Springfield, Litchfield, and Edwardsville. Baseball games are becoming a part of the broader movement, playing back to the roots of the game. Major League Baseball will be having a third installment of their Field of Dreams game this summer in a cornfield in Dyersville, Iowa, based on that movie's location. Despite the Slammers losing to the Gateway Grizzlies 14-3, Darren Thurman, tourism manager for the Springfield, Illinois Convention and Visitors Bureau, was awestruck by the event. Thurman claims it's one of the most unique events he's helped organize. "Yeah, I mean, when could you play in an old prison? You know, there's just so much history here," Thurman said. "You think about the stories and the people that existed here. I saw the players warming up, and they had their phones out, and they were just filming around them inside this, you know, this old stone. So I thought it was really cool." And it says, Chloe Park of the Meadle, Illinois News Bureau contributed to this story. Julia Levy, who wrote the story, is a graduate student in journalism with Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism, Media, Integrated Marketing Communications, and a fellow in its Medill, Illinois News Bureau, working in partnership with Capital News Illinois. Chancellor warns of climate in the U.S. by Morris Wackett and Matthias Williams of Reuters. German Chancellor Friedrich Merz said Friday he would advise his children against living or studying in the United States at the moment, citing a rapidly changing social climate and limited opportunities even for the highly educated. The remarks highlight tensions between the U.S. and its European allies under President Donald Trump, with disputes over trade and the wars in Ukraine and Iran straining the NATO alliance. Last month, Merz said the U.S. was being humiliated in the Iran war, angering Trump. Days later, Washington announced a partial troop withdrawal from Germany and tariff hikes on European Union cars, a sector where Germany is strong. Speaking to a young audience at a Catholic convention in Würzburg, Merz said people were too prone to think in disaster mode about the state of the world and urged Germans to feel more optimistic about their own country's potential. "I firmly believe there are few countries in the world that offer such great opportunities, especially for young people, as Germany," he said. "I wouldn't recommend that my children go to the U.S. today, get their education there, and work there simply because a social climate has suddenly developed there," said Merz, a 70-year-old father of three. "Today, the best educated people in America have great difficulty finding a job," he noted. Merz took office last year as a self-professed transatlanticist, but since criticized Germany's most powerful ally. Trump, in turn, said Merz should focus on fixing his own broken country. "I am a great admirer of America," Merz told his audience. My admiration isn't growing at the moment, however," he said, to laughter and applause. And in the digest section, at least four killed when Ukraine strikes Russia, Kiev, Ukraine. At least four people were killed, including three in the Moscow region, after Ukraine launched its biggest overnight drone attack on the Russian capital in more than a year, local officials said Sunday. A fourth person was killed in the Belgorod region bordering northeastern Ukraine, local authorities said, while Russian authorities While Russia's defense ministry said that by midday, more than 1,000 Ukrainian drones had been downed over the country in the past 24 hours. Ukraine's President Vladimir Zelensky vowed retribution Friday following Russia's heaviest drone and missile attack on Kiev over a two-day period since the war started more than 4 years ago. Mexico armed attack kills at least 10 people. 10 people, including a minor, were killed Sunday in an armed attack in Mexico's Puebla state, the state's public security ministry said. The victims, 6 men, 3 women, and a child, were targeted by armed individuals in the municipality of Tehuantzingo, the state ministry added. State and federal forces launched a joint investigation and operational deployment to find the perpetrators. The state's public security ministry pledged zero impunity for the killings. Briefly, in Gaza Strip, Israeli strikes killed at least 8 Palestinians on Sunday in the Gaza Strip, health officials said, as ceasefire efforts meant to end fighting between Israel and the Hamas militant group failed. Separately, Gaza medics said another Israeli airstrike killed at least 3 people at a community kitchen near Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Bala in central Gaza. In under elections, Peru's top electoral authority pledged Sunday to correct flaws that delayed April's first round election results by a month ahead of the presidential runoff scheduled for June 7th. The finalists for the presidency are right-wing candidate Keiko Fujimori and leftist Roberto Sanchez. And from Taipei, Taiwan will not be sacrificed or traded and will not give up its free way of life under pressure, President Lai Ching-te wrote on social media Sunday, adding that U.S. arms sales to the island were a security commitment based on law. Lai's comments were his first response to last week's summit between President Donald Trump and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. Thomas Massie. President Donald Trump's repeated attacks on intra-party critic Representative Thomas Massie reflect a desperate attempt to help his opponent in Tuesday's Kentucky primary, the lawmaker said Sunday. In a social media post Sunday, Trump called Massie the worst Republican congressman in history. In Idaho, 4 crew members involved in a mid-air collision of military jets and an air show ejected safely Sunday outside Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho, the U.S. Navy said. 2 EA-18G Growler jets collided in mid-air 2 miles from the base during the Gunfighter Skies air show, a spokesperson said. And from Havana, Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez accused the U.S. on Sunday of fabricating a fraudulent case to justify economic sanctions and potential military intervention. The minister's comments followed a report by Axios on Sunday that said Cuba had acquired more than 300 military drones. And it says podcast, and it has a code here, but that doesn't help you because you don't have a phone. And a couple of today in history events. In 1860, Abraham Lincoln was chosen on the third ballot at the Republican National Convention in Chicago to be the party's nominee for president. In 1917, President Woodrow Wilson signed the Selective Service Act to build the American Armed Forces through a conscription to aid the Allies during World War I. In 1933, as part of the President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, Congress created the Tennessee Valley Authority as a utility and regional economic development agency. In 1953, piloting a borrowed Canadair F-86 jet, trailblazing aviator Jacqueline Cochran added to her list of records and firsts by becoming the first woman to break the sound barrier. In 1969, the Apollo 10 launched from Kennedy Space Center in Florida on its mission to orbit the moon as a dress rehearsal for the moon landing during the Apollo 11 mission. And in 1980, after nearly 2 months of activity, Mount St. Helens erupted in southern Washington. The eruption killed 57 people, destroyed or damaged 200 homes, and deposited ash across 11 states. And we'll stop right there with part 1. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for part 2.